So we were watching this, and you said something to me. What did you say?
There was a point at which we were seeing a scene familiar to anybody who had gone over to Baghdad during the times when we went to bring medicines in violation of the economic sanctions. A sort of standard visit was to Mutanabi Street, which was the place where the intellectuals gathered and they put all their books out on the sidewalk, and almost as long as it wasn't pouring rain, they could always reliably be there. It's not possible anymore. It's closed down.
And who closed it down? What happened to the street?
Well, I think probably for security, it wasn't possible for people to stand outside there and be so evident and to show their connection to places outside Baghdad.
Yeah. I was so struck, because when I went with you to Iraq in 2003, when I first walked down that street, it was the books. I've never seen books being sold on the street like that, laid out. And it was such a beautiful day. And what I realized was the rhythm and the movements of the sheets of paper flying through, you know? And it sort of haunted me ever since, seeing all these books flapping in the wind as you were walking down the street. And I realized also how diverse the books were. It was French books, Arabic books, Chinese books, from civil engineering books to mathematic books to a book by Rimbaud. I was just so shocked, really, you know?
I lived in Basra for a summer, and there was one book in the whole house. It was really a magazine, but it had been read over and over and over again. The pages were all kind of worn out. I think there's tremendous pride, but it's actually your animation of the shapes coming apart and the kind of sinister weapons coming in that I think speaks maybe more clearly to what's happening in Iraq today, that it's just so easy to forget about it all, to back away. We can't go in there. We can't see. If you went to visit anybody you went to visit before the shock and awe invasion, you'd put their lives in danger. So I think there's a sort of an entrapment, and it's a bit like thinking about Lynn going off to prison, Lynn Stewart, that you just disappear, and there's a kind of a throw away the key mentality, perhaps, that the closing of that street, I think, in fact, is a good symbol for what's happening to so many people in Iraq today who just have to say goodbye to a life and a history and a culture. And they didn't ask for any of it. They didn't do anything to bring it on themselves, I don't think.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Let's back up a bit. And I think I knew you. When did I meet you? I met you in Iraq. But before that, I knew you through a punk rock magazine named Punk Planet, run by a good friend of mine, Dan Sinker, who I used to write articles about the Teamsters for him in Chicago, and he had a real political streak, so he would, Jeff Gunsel, is Jeff here? Jeff? Oh, he didn't even make it.
Plug his website anyway.
Jeff Gunsel was the one who was writing articles about you and voices for Punk Planet, and then I met Jeff, and he convinced me 2 hours after a bad Mexican lunch to go to Iraq as part of the Iraq peace team. But you guys started in 1996. Can you talk a little bit about your work previous to 96, and then what made you want to start Voices in the Wilderness, which is actually now defunct now, which is now disbanded, and we should talk a little bit about that as well. Mm-hmm. But what prompted you to start the group in 96 in Chicago?
Well, the question for me is, why did we wait so long? I was very persuaded by a fellow named Ammon Hennessy, who had once said, you can't be a vegetarian between meals, and you can't be a pacifist between wars. And it's easy to say, okay, I don't include weapons in my personal budget. I'm a war tax refuser. I haven't paid since 1979. I've done my year in prison for planting corn on the nuclear missile silo sites. But it seems to me that when we're so readily sending off 18, 19, 20-year-olds who haven't had a chance to live their lives, who many of them haven't had a whole lot of other options, and they can go off to war zones, isn't there some chance that if the people who would very much like to see an alternative might themselves go into the war zones and try to better understand what's happening, that this would open up some space, there might be some possibilities that would come out of that. There haven't. I think the peace team concept is like a little 2-year-old learning how to walk at this point. So I joined a peace team in 1991, and we were parked on the Iraq side of the Iraq-Saudi border. And then I came back to the United States in August, and I didn't really have any kind of a footing in the academic world in terms of commentary on the Middle East. I didn't speak Arabic. I certainly wasn't an expert. There were other things to become involved in, and so Iraq receded more and more in my own mind. And I suppose for those of us who had been over there either before or during or after that first Gulf War, if we weren't paying much attention to the economic sanctions, who did we think would? And those sanctions kept going from 1992 till they started in August 1990, but what I mean is after the war had ended, I think Iraq went off of almost everybody's radar screen. But then the United Nations workers that were doing some of the studies of infant mortality were suggesting that it could be that there were as many as 500,000 children under age 5 who died because of the economic sanctions. So finally, a number of us thought, well, we could try. We could try to do something. And then realizing we couldn't be a humanitarian relief group, we could do what we do know how to do, which is to defy laws that we believe we don't want to be governed by. So we did. We just decided that we would bring medicines and medical relief supplies. We never talked about toys, really, because it was such a grave situation. We wanted to be taken seriously as people that were going ahead with something that was desperately needed, and that we just go to Iraq. And I think people in governing circles in Iraq were so isolated by then that they may have thought, well, you know, we don't know who these people are. We probably would execute them if they were in our society trying to break laws, but, you know, let them come and maybe, you know, stick them on somebody we don't like. It might have been that that's about as much credibility as we had when we first went. But this is something that I think is important. If you wait till you're perfect, you'll wait a long time. We know that in our personal lives. And we certainly were flawed and imperfect and clumsy and stumbling, all of the adjectives you could think of to describe a very motley crew. But we did build relationships. I mean, it just happens. You start to meet people. You can't be a good judge of character all your life long, and then all of a sudden it suspends because you crossed a border. So, and particularly through a mutual friend of ours named George, we began to meet the extended families of some people we'd gotten to know. And
George,
yes.
George Capaccio?
George Capaccio.
Oh, really?
So that's how it began to grow, and it always should have been, really, a small organization, because we worked out of my apartment, a three-bedroom apartment on the north side of Chicago. We were funded, I mean, in a way you could say we embezzled from my father's pension and Social Security check, but we took very good care of him. and we rubbed shoulders with some of the finest people in the world, and we had a great deal of I think respect and trust.
But here's a. But let's. I just want to back up for 1 second. There are many people who think things are going badly, things will go wrong in many parts of the world. I mean, even in our country, New Orleans becomes one of those places where things go terribly wrong. Man-made disaster, natural disasters on top of man-made disasters. But and there are so many ways to engage: giving to the Red Cross, giving money, going to events and things like this. But you guys in 96 decided to go to Iraq, which is fairly radical still to this day. You know, I remember telling my friends and family that I was going to go with you guys. And the first, they ignored it. They thought I didn't say anything. They wouldn't even comment. It's as if I was just whistling, you know what I mean? Because it was beyond the pale of what they imagined an appropriate response might be. So at what point, like what made it possible? What made it possible for this kind of response, going to Iraq, breaking federal law, which now we've been convicted of, what made it possible as opposed to impossible, you know? I think of that graffiti that was graffitied around France in May of 68 that said, you know, be realistic, demand the impossible. And in a way, hearing you guys and knowing you guys going to Iraq, around, you know, planning things around a kitchen table in 96, thinking you're going to go to Iraq to do something, that's fairly radical. Like, at what point did you, like, jump off the cliff?
Well, I think it was, in fact, for me, it was knowing that two women, they might have each weighed about 103 pounds. They were in their late 60s. They were religious nuns, Anne Montgomery and Eileen Story, and you know, little backpacks on their back and quavering when they came back, saying it's really bad over there. And there was a sense that there wasn't anybody else who was going to cut in line in front of us and say, we'll take care of that. I think I know some of the most kindly, stubborn people in the United States. And there was a good sense of stubbornness. When people say that's off limits, I know some people who will say, who said, and take a bit of a risk in that regard. And also if somebody says, well, if you do that, you might incur on yourself a great fine. Well, most of the people who went hadn't paid their taxes in decades in the beginning, and so we just kind of say, well, add it to the tab. But we always said, we didn't mean to be rude. We'd always say, to our local U.S. attorney and to anybody who'd listen at higher levels that we thanked them for the clarity of the warnings. We said we wouldn't be governed by unjust laws. We invited them to join us if they wanted to. And then if we're threatened with prison, most of us had already done jail time too. So it's good not to be governed by fears. We know that. I think what's very troublesome is when whole societies and cultures, and we see this in our own country with Katrina, which I know is so much on your mind now, Paul, and on my mind always, every time I leave a prison, I feel like I've left a huge crime, and I'm walking away, and I know that it's just like when you come back from a third world country, it takes 8 seconds to readjust to electricity, right? You know that you're going to get so adjusted to not having to do 4 o'clock count and not having any question about when you can pick up the phone or be able to walk freely. Well, there are so many people trapped by causes that have everything to do with the way we live our lives, with our comforts, with what we take for granted. But it's just obscured and far away, and I think it's to our detriment if we don't try to break those barriers and cross those borders and be stubborn and say, what the First Amendment, I suppose, has said that we should be able to do, to assemble peacefully for redress of grievance. We've got these great grievances, but sometimes you have to know people face to face and be able to say this is what we've seen and heard to constitute what the grievance is, which in my opinion often is that we don't want to keep killing people. How can we learn to live together without killing one another?
You were coming, you're based in Chicago, but you were just in Georgia. You want to tell people what you were doing in Georgia?
I started out in Alabama. A group of people walking toward Columbus, Georgia, were trying to reenact the Selma to Montgomery marches of the Civil Rights era. I think there were some disappointments interwoven in that. It didn't become as big an occasion as people had hoped. But the reason for heading toward Columbus is because there is a school at Fort Benning, Georgia, tucked inside the huge Fort Benning base, which does train people. And you can see it in manuals that were used formerly, but mainly in consulting a list of the graduates of the school and people who have been convicted of some of the worst crimes against humanity in Central and South America. This place, the School of the Americas, is what it was formerly called. They changed their name also, but they haven't become defunct. Now it's called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security. And out of that school has come people who were responsible for assassinations, kidnappings, murders, disappearances, massacres. And so every year people congregate. This year I'm sure there will be 20,000 people there today. And I never went to Woodstock. I was sort of always the nerd. But this probably has a Woodstocky feel to it. You know, it's a beautiful sunny day in Columbus, Georgia. The base people are very familiar with this now as something that on Sunday will transform into a completely silent funeral procession, and people carry a cross bearing the name of someone who was killed by a graduate of this school in Central or South America. All the names are sung out, and then the word presente. And usually 30 to 50 people will cross the line. And as soon as you cross the line carrying that cross, you know you're going to get 3 months or possibly 6 months if it's the second time doing so in federal prison.
How many terms have you served from working at SOA, doing the SOA?
Just one for me.
How long was it?
I served 3 months in Pekin Prison in the spring of 2004.
2004. You know, before, I know on my list of things I want to ask you about is about prison work. But what I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about is the other defunct group that you mentioned, Voices in the Wilderness. What happened to us?
Well, what happened to us is that initially we were threatened with 12 years in prison, a $1 million fine, and a $250,000 administrative penalty, and that has shrunk quite a bit. It came down
to breaking sanctions.
Yeah, for bringing medicines over to Iraq. Now that ended up being a $20,000 fine, and Judge Bates wrote on page 18 of his opinion a quote from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, in which Dr. King said those who break an unjust law should do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to pay the penalty. And so we wanted to say, well, if you want to put us in jail, we'll go openly and lovingly. We've tried to do that in the past.
Hey.
And Paul, I know, would want to come right with us. But but we won't pay one dime to help support warfare that we think was unprovoked and belligerent and continues to kill innocent people. So that's where it stands right now. This $20,000 fine is hovering, but we really don't want them to take money out of a bank account that we would run. So we ran down the bank account to just about zero. And but we didn't want to walk away from concerns of people in Iraq. I know that would be a hideous thing to do at this point. Or from continually trying to challenge United States militarism in general at home and abroad. So we form Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We're from Chicago, and this is what the mafia does.
When I heard that was what happened, I don't mean to curse, but I told Danny, a mutual friend who coordinates for Voices, I said, this must be the big fuck you move, because they convict a group and you just disband and start another group. Yeah, I guess it is like the mafia, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if we're going to do pat lines, I would give money to the mafia sooner than I would give it to the United States government at this point. Because of what the government is doing with U.S. wealth and productivity, I mean, $527 billion invested into defense spending for many weapon systems that won't even come into existence, some of them until 10 years from now. And you're just back from New Orleans, and people in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina were left to float in the water and pull the corpses out themselves.
Yeah, it was really, it was in lieu of a federal, state, and city response, it was people getting together to fend for themselves. And it's not as Darwinian as it sounds. I think still to this day, it's Common Ground Collective is the only private, all-volunteer-based organization doing work of gutting houses in the lower and upper ninth. There's nary a sign of response from FEMA or Red Cross. And I think it's tragicomic. I mean Beckett's great word, the tragicomic is still with us in New Orleans. And I certainly saw that in Iraq when we were there too. People living their lives, not necessarily depressed, but certainly has the weight and responsibility of feeling like they had to rebuild their society on their own. And I think it's hard to watch, it's hard to look. And then to imagine what an appropriate response would be for someone who don't live in Iraq or who do not live in New Orleans, what can people do? Like, what do you do besides, like, be melancholic or sad or angry, you know?
Well, I don't have a lot of optimistic things to say right now with regard to Iraq. If it's all right, I'd like to maybe shift. I tend to have a very free schedule. I can go where I want pretty easily, especially...
Because you have no real job.
Because I have no real job, yeah. So I went racing over to the third round of a trial in Dublin. The group of people whom I know, one of whom I knew quite well, had done $2.5 million worth of damage to a United States Navy warplane parked
with
on the
hammer,
tarmac,
right?
Of Shannon Airport.
They ran out and started banging on a plane.
And
that's insane, Kathy.
So when they were working out their defense with three of the finest barristers in all Ireland, who really wanted to get them off, they wanted to see an acquittal, the judge was saying, well, what motivated you? And they said, well, we heard Kathy Kelly give a talk. So this trial has fallen apart and fallen apart and fallen apart. because judges have Irish tempers and other things. And so finally, in this past summer, the trial was going full steam ahead. There was a woman as judge, and she allowed me in. She only allowed me in as the defense witness, and that made me very, very nervous. She said, well, Miss Kelly can speak to that. And of course, I'm law fringe. And she had dismissed Dennis Halliday with 34 years of experience at the United Nations as the humanitarian coordinator in Iraq. So we were very, very anxious for these five, thinking that they were going to face almost certain conviction and perhaps long prison sentences. But one of the barristers, well, all three barristers in their summations gave such brilliant oration that I think that is really what got them off. And one man, Mr. Nix, he said, the problem isn't did these five have a lawful excuse to do what they did. The question is, what's our excuse for not doing more? And he had begun by saying that he was trying to make the point that these five acted in a faith-based way and not political. So he started, the greatest political document of all time was the Sermon on the Mount, and the greatest pacifist of all time was Jesus. And he started reading to this Dublin working-class jury the Sermon on the Mount. It was a very unusual approach. And and then he changed gears, and he described a beautiful day in a London park. In fact, it reminds me of some of your animation, Paul, where, you know, the kids are humping each other. It's beautiful,
hey,
really.
I didn't draw anyone humping, did I?
That's what the newspaper said.
Oh, right.
But anyway, it was just a charming, wonderful day for him. The kids were chasing the ducks up the hill. The ducks were chasing the children down the hill. And then his face darkened, and he was thundering, and he said, they're bombing children in a swimming hole. In Lebanon, children are swimming in a pool of their own blood. And I honestly didn't know what he was talking about. I had to run for The Guardian and read it that night. A swimming canal, I mean, an actual canal and a swimming hole in it, had taken a direct hit during the Israeli-Hezbollah war. And 11 children were swimming at the time. Three of them were killed. And then Mr. Nix asked the question, would you not try if you could to stop a Hezbollah missile from slamming into a village in northern Israel? Would you not try, if you could, to stop an Israeli missile from hitting a swimming canal in southern Lebanon? What will rise you? And I think that's the kind of question. We were all on trial. It flipped it completely. So I did go to Lebanon and saw just massive ashen heaps of rubble. You know, I stayed overnight in a house where there were three cluster bombs just in the garden outside the house. I'd had the idea to take all the broken glass we'd swept up and dump it in the garden. And fortunately, this young man said, no, my mother won't like that. Well, good thing, because in that garden were three unexploded cluster bombs. I mean, the devastation, the wreckage. But the thing that's so different from my other experience of being in war zones is that Hezbollah, and I wouldn't be equipped at all to have a long discussion on Hezbollah's past track record, but they did immediately start to stack up money that they very likely got because Iran had a good year of oil sales revenue, but they $12,000 stacks of cash were distributed to each person in the suburb called the Dahia to begin rebuilding. People were directed, here's where you can go to get furniture, here's where you can get your temporary housing. And as we watched it, those of us who were from the United States, we just were saying, wow, if these folks could give some advice to FEMA in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, that would be quite a valuable thing. So it is possible for people to take care of one another. It is possible for people to have the political will and the determination and to say we're going to rearrange our priorities. But it's not possible if we're kept so undereducated, so ill-informed and so caught up in this rat race, the mandatory shopping and the mandatory activities that we all have to pay attention to in our society, we really lose a lot, I think.
Do you, a lot of these ideas that you're talking about come through, I don't know if people know, but you write as well as travel a lot because you don't have a full-time job and you go around to different trials. And a lot of your ideas come through these writings that you do. A lot of your writings are on Counterpunch. You have a book out called Other Land of Dreams, and I think it's interesting to hear you talk about these ideas through these stories and experiences. And I think here's at this point where I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your work in prison, your prison work. I started reading your columns in Counterpunch and other places about your experience at the Pekin prison. It was certainly documented in the book. And it just behooves me to sort of ask you about your experience in prison and also your perspective on how that becomes a kind of creative nonviolent work, a kind of civil disobedient work. Because like how what you talked about, the sort of imaginative jump of imagining, what if we can learn from Hezbollah? And what can FEMA learn from what they're doing or not doing? I mean, down in New Orleans, it's like they have these they have these home loan programs, and only less than 100 people in New Orleans have gotten these loan programs, mm-hmm. and it's been more than a year now. This has been constant. This sense of bureaucracy, this kind of linking, right? This linking that stops things from actually moving on, so that it's the smaller outfits that get in there and get things done, irrespective of how much money they have. Like these Common Ground folks, this collective called Common Ground, they've been down there since January, gutting houses. And when I was down there 2 days ago, it was run by like a 23-year-old mm-hmm. from Colby College in San Francisco, Matt Sandin, and the neighborhood. And I was just shocked. There was no other organization around in the Upper Ninth. Like a 23-year-old was running it. And thank God for 23-year-olds, you know what I mean? But in any case, can you talk a little bit about the Pekin prison experience and just like the prison work in general and how it connects to creative nonviolence?
Well, I think I'm preternaturally extroverted and probably pretty nosy too. But in my last experience, I couldn't help, given where I was situated on the top bunk right next to a bank of phones, I really couldn't help but more or less eavesdrop on many, many telephone conversations. And something that surprised me was the repetitive, almost predictable nature of these calls. And what it brings home to me is this very, very common experience of women who have 7, 8, sometimes 15 years in prison. And they, you know, gear themselves up to make the call, and then, you know, have timed it, have sent a postcard in advance asking the grandmother who's with their children, you know, please have the kids home and near the phone at 12 noon on Saturday. That's when I'm going to call. And then, you know, the phone rings, and you hear a woman after the tape says, "This is a call from a federal prison. This phone call will be monitored. If you wish to accept this call, press 7. If you wish to reject it, press 5. If you wish to reject all future calls, press 3. It's just the heart is beating. You know, is whoever picked up the phone going to get it right or reject all future calls? And then you would hear a woman say, "Hi, are the kids there? They're not. They went to a birthday party. Oh, and were they able to bring a present? Oh, I know, Mama. You're really hurting for money, Mama. That's why I called. I'm out of stamps." And then it would be, "I'm out of yarn to knit an afghan for Grandma, and I don't have enough money for shampoo. Well, it's this new pay-to-stay program. Well, is there any chance that Uncle Robert could drive the kids to see me at Christmas time?" And, you know, when women would hang up the phone regularly, I'd see a woman make a hairpin turn into a shower stall, into a bathroom stall, and then come out, and her face would be tear-stained, swollen, her eyes red. But my regular experience was that the people that I got to know would find some kind of courage to put on whatever face was needed to face the remainder of the day after a very disappointing phone call, the remainder of the week, of the month, of the year, and of what often are 8, 9, 10-year sentences now. When I was in prison in 1988, if we saw a woman with a 10-year sentence, we'd all be whispering, "That woman, 9 years." And now, it's not unusual. I was there with 300 women. 82% had committed nonviolent crimes, mainly drug-related. Of that number, 1/4 had sentences of 8 years or longer. And in the prison next door, you could watch the young fellows shuffling off the bus when they arrived, and they're, you know, manacled and shackled at their ankles, And the median sentence length for the men's prison, a medium to high security prison, was 27 years. So these men would be youngsters when they walked in, and they'd be grandfathers when they walked out. So people have to cope with society creating for them a kind of a new personality. I never knew anybody in prison who wanted to be a neglectful mother, who wanted to be separated from community and family for long lengths of time with a terrible stigma and with memories that she couldn't erase and with almost nothing touching therapy. I mean, we were here earlier, many of us, for a delightful conversation about therapy and all the wonderful things that therapy can do for individuals and for their romantic life and their erotic life and their relational life and to do away with an artificial shortage of love. It was a challenging and a wonderful conversation. But believe me, once people go behind those bars, those prisons that you drive past and you see the cement wall and the barbed wire, there's no therapy being offered for those people. There's just punishment, punishment, and more punishment. I was so glad to read that Richard Gere and his wife, Richard Gere? Sorry, isn't he a movie star?
The Buddhist guy?
Yeah, the Buddhist guy. He's going to do a reading of writings from people in prison here in New York. I think it's November 30th.
The Buddhist guy? Really?
The Buddhist guy. But that's the kind of thing that can part the curtains a little bit. And when we've got these huge walls, at least get a gate, a door, some way to take a glimpse inside. The fastest growing new industry in this country is the prison industry. And we know it's not an answer. We know, I mean, we can all say now, well, the Iraq War, that wasn't a very good answer, was it? No, that was a very bad answer. Yeah, that was a disaster, in fact. We all can say it about the war on drugs and about the consequent locking up of so many people. But it's the throwaway, the key mentality. The lives were already, which is why I was so drawn to that animation in the final showing, Paul, that the lives are already broken apart. Why go into prisons? Well, it is an education. You do get a chance to catch some courage from some of the most determined people in the world, people who have decided my life is not going to be over, even though, you know, I've got 8 or 10 years trapped inside this prison. I think when we look at the environmental catastrophes that could be looming, you know, that we might like to wish away, but that's the real terror we all face. I mean, that's what requires so much newness, so much redesigning of our way of thinking, so much stepping outside of the box, so much liberation of ourselves to really deal with the main problems that the next generations inevitably will have to cope with, and much of it, you know, inheriting our looting, or criminal behavior toward the planet. I don't want anybody to go to prison, but I do think we could all stand a lot of rehabilitation. So when you go inside a prison, you get to flip it a little bit. You get a chance to slow down and think hard and wonder about what a different world might look like. And the first time I was locked up, I learned Spanish. Now I want to learn Arabic, so I think I need a 10-year sentence. And you don't feel so governed by fears. You don't feel so governed by fears. And really, all the guards know that their prisoners are closer to them in many ways than the administration or the judges or some of the, you know, high-ranking legal authorities who've helped to design this system.
Ass kicking.
We have to quit.
Yeah, we do. That's the sound, but we'll take as many questions as we can before they kick us out. So if there are any questions for either of us, we'd be happy to take them.
And we should also say our sincere thanks to the
thank
New York
you
Public
for,
Library.
Yeah, and to, Creative Time and Pastor
Creative
Peter Time
and
Gavin. Yes, thank you. Are there any questions? I don't know if we need a mic, but if there are any questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Hi, I wanted to ask Kathy, I wasn't clear from the presentation if you had been back to Iraq since Shock and Awe, and I was wondering about the destruction of the museum and the cultural artifacts. I'm a public school teacher too, and I note that no ancient history is really taught, say, in fifth grade in America. And this dumbing down of culture, I feel like, I don't know, we've lost 10,000 years of history, and I wanted to know if you know anything about the reconstruction of the museums or what is being done, if they're locked up. I heard the library was burned to the ground, you know, and I was thinking about the books that were for sale. Do you guys know anything?
Well, you have here in New York Kathy Breen in front, who I'll be leaving, but she's a New Yorker, and she's been back to Iraq, and I also in the north of Iraq in May of 2006, this year. It wasn't possible for us to go into central or southern Iraq since 2004. We haven't been there. When we were in we were there during the Shock and Awe bombing, and when the Marines came in, it might have been a bit naive of us, but we thought, well, we'll send Kathy over with our friend Rumsey with a little list of things that the Marines might need to know about where the hospitals are and where the clinics are and where there's some blankets being stored, and that there is reportedly an outbreak of cholera in Hilla, and the garbage hasn't been picked up for a month. And, you know, we'd had a friendly relationship with many of the young Marines stationed right outside where we were. But at one point, big, huge refrigerator boxes of rocket-propelled grenades were being removed from the art gallery right next door to us. And so finally, we said to the Marines, you might want to notice what's happening. They didn't interfere with the looting. But then when we told them, you know, those are rocket-propelled grenades being looted, then they went over and boarded up the building. The only building to which they assigned any kind of protection was the Ministry of Oil. And so I think that the cards were played in a pretty clear way with that decision. It was just unbelievable to us that they didn't have a plan. When Kathy and others went over to talk about this outbreak of cholera in Hilla, the Paul Bremers eventually came, but Jay Gardner's group asked, was that a street in Baghdad? And we said, no, that's a second largest city in central Iraq. I think there was not at all a readiness to see Iraq thrive.
You in the front?
My question is to you that what do you think about Iraq? That are you really hopeful that is there going to be any peace or stability? Are you hopeful?
In the near term future, the question is, am I hopeful that there will be peace and stability in Iraq? I think that it's a situation today in central and southern Iraq where chaos has started to prevail more and more on a daily basis. I have some hope that if the United States people would demand that the troops come home and that a generous package of reparations be entrusted, and I mean a very generous one that would be on a par with, let's say, the $7 billion per month that's being spent to maintain the current U.S. military presence in Iraq. If the bases were shut down and a package of reparations were made available and the United States didn't try to say, but we'll control that expenditure, if the United States would admit we're uniquely unqualified to be in charge of any reconstruction in Iraq at this point. And I think the United Nations is the only referee on the bench. So I don't know if I'd call it hope, but I have certainly read statements that seem to suggest that there are some thinking people with compassionate hearts at the level of intelligentsia in this country. Certainly go hear Mark Danner when he speaks here in New York City.
I want to add with this question that do you think the last result and outcome of the election is going to change any U.S. policy to Iraq and it will make the situation any better?
Well, there's a $166 billion appropriation bill that President Bush has requested, and I'm not aware of one Democrat other than Mr. Kucinich who's speaking up and saying that money ought not be spent. I think that we have to acknowledge that the number one lobby on Capitol Hill in this country is the defense lobby. And that any elected representative that goes out on that limb with a saw behind himself or herself and thinks, I'm going to take them on, is certainly a very brave person. And I think we need to say to the elected reps, we'll take risks too. It's not just about you. We'll take risks. We don't want to be people known all around the world as an imperial menace. And if we want to change that, it's going to take some very concrete steps. Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peacefully for redress of grievance. You own those senators and congresspersons' offices. They rent them and you pay the rent. So we should be in those offices. February 5th marks an anniversary, in a sense, of Colin Powell going before the world and the United Nations Security Council and saying that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Well, they didn't. And this was not truthful at all. The United States trespassed into a sovereign country and has created huge wreckage. So I think it's a good idea on that day, February 5th, we're beginning what we're calling the Occupation Project. And we want people not just to go one day to your elected representative's office, go back again and again and again. You could sing the names of the people that have been killed, both US and Iraqi. Sergeant First Class Ryan Clancy, 35 years old, presente. Ahmed Mustafa, 3 years old, presente. Present those names. Go in wearing the pictures. We'll give them to you. Have your pre-meetings and have the talking points worked out. And come together in affinity groups. This is how we take our freedom. You don't get freedom, you take it, you exercise it. And we are a country at war, and I think that really there is a risk for the next generations if we don't assert ourselves as people who don't want to be an imperial menace. And I'm not a militant, sectarian, political representative of some. They wouldn't have me, those parties. I'm a pacifist. I'm a Catholic high school religion teacher. But we can think really hard about ways to go forward and change the situation that will really reflect in a most exceedingly difficult way on next generations here.
I think that second bell means Homeland Security is here.
I think that's the very thing.
I think we're going to have to end it. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.